expulsion, and also a conference with our labor negotiators about negotiations. The first thing we need to do on the action agenda is the consensus on the order of businesses. So I look around. Is everybody good on the order of business?
Mr. President?
Yes, Mr. Millar, you're there.
Thank you all again for accommodating me long business. If I could, under the discussion items on the agenda, if we could, unless there are people there to speak on other items.
If we could move the construction planning process up, I would appreciate it. But if there are folks there or who are scheduled to be there to speak about these items, then that's fine. It's just that it's 9 o'clock back here.
Okay. Is that okay with Mr. Palazzo? Is there anybody here that wishes to speak about the construction issues that may arise from passage of Measure D?
Hey, Walter. I would support that after item 5.02 and before item 5.03.
Oh, no. I was just suggesting that we do it at before 9.01.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
I didn't want to move ahead of all the other stuff.
Okay.
If that's okay.
So... Mr. Unger, do you still wish to put it in as item 5.?
Well, I think I would because I understand it's 9 o'clock where Mr. Millar is, I would suggest perhaps after 6.02.
Okay, 6.02. Okay, before the business update.
Right. Would that and then we can have public comment. We can go through that, public comment, and then get to the business update. Is that... I don't know.
That would be fine, but I'm willing to let it go later in the agenda. Heck, I'll just go along with how it's done. But if that's okay with everybody, I appreciate it. I think Chris knows what.
I just don't want to hear you snoring. Is what we're a little concerned about.
The phone doesn't have a mute. I'm sorry.
If the other members of the board are all right with that, we will move item 9.03 to before the superintendent's updates. That's item 7.01. And that's agreeable to the board, Mr. Millar. So,
thank you all. And I have had an opportunity to review all the items and the supporting materials for the other items on the agenda. But I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. And we know you're there. okay, so we have action on a stipulated student discipline agreement. Do we need a motion on it first? Is there a motion?
No.
I'll move approval to accept the expulsion as stipulated.
I'll second.
Okay, so we have Mr. Unger making the motion and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Is there any further discussion on this? Okay, all in favor of the motion, indicate by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
And one abstention.
And one abstention. So the motion carries 6.0 and one absence, Mr. Millar, is how we're going to report that. No, one abstention. Because he is here at the moment. Okay, thank you.
Well, I wasn't there in the discussion, even though I did review them.
So you
material.
Are abstaining. Okay, that's fine. Thank you. All right. And thank you, Mrs. Holmes, for keeping us on the straight and narrow here. Okay. All right, we are now on the approval of minutes from the October 7th meeting. Has everybody had a chance to look at the minutes? Okay.
I will move approval of the minutes of what is the date?
October 7th.
October 7th.
Okay. And Mr. Buckman seconds it. So Mrs. Roger moves the approval of the minutes, and Mr. Buckman seconds it. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, they're approved 7-0. Okay, it's our time for presentations. Item 5.01, student representatives to the board. I just want to introduce them to our audience. We have John O. Roberts from the president, the ASB president of San Luis Obispo High School. And with him is Eli Kukol. He was the ASB secretary. And Grant Edmonds, who is representing Morro Bay High School and has no official title other than representative to the school board. Okay, so it's a good title. Yes, that's a fine title. So who's speaking to us first? Okay, Mr. Edwards.
Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Edmonds. Thank you, Mr. Edmonds.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and now we're going to hear from what's going on at San Luis High. Jono.
Hi. Thanks for the coffee. I liked it. It was good. So this week is also our homecoming week. Yesterday was our Sports Madness Day. We had a lot of people dress up in jerseys. It was a real good turnout. Really good, not real good, but speaking in some street slang there. So that was really cool. We had some people dress out in basketball jerseys, some school apparel, some major league apparel, some minor league apparel. I came out in a full Oakland Athletics outfit borrowed by one of my dad's friends. So we just tried to boost that up. And today was our tacky tourist day, so we saw a lot of some Hawaiian shirts and a lot of hats and some Polaroid cameras and some cargo shorts and, of course, the socks and flip-flops. They're an essential for that outfit. And tomorrow is our Wacky Wednesday, which is really open to interpretation. I know I'm going to wear this toupee wig that's definitely not the same color as my hair. I know we'll have some people wearing some ballroom dresses that, you know, are excessively extravagant, especially if you're just going to be taking a chemistry test. And on Thursday is the day where we have each class dressed up as their decades assigned to them. So our freshmen, these are in no order. They got to pick first and second and third. So the freshmen are the 70s, so we'll be seeing a lot of bell-bottom jeans. Our sophomores are the 50s, so we're going to be seeing a lot of those poodle skirts and some slick back hair. Then our juniors are the 60s, so we know they're going to take it off with the Beatles and a lot of hippie music. Hopefully, we're hoping to keep it contained to no drug references, so that's our job on that day. And then our our senior class is going to be the 80s, so we're going to have a lot of leg warmers, some neon clothes. I know I'm dressing up as Marty McFly from Back to the Future, so I'll have the vest, the jeans, the jean jacket, the shirt, and I'll be looking at my watch the entire time. And so Friday we have our black and gold day, and then we will have our outside rally, which will be on the field. And what we do is we bring all the students out there, and they'll get all excited, and then we'll have the homecoming parade afterwards where every student gets on their float. We have sports teams, we have clubs, we have classes, and we'll all go downtown and loop around while we have an announcer who's one of our staff members who says, oh, here we have the sophomore float. They're the 50s. Give them a hand, folks. And we'll have people by Pete's Coffee, either saying, turn that down, or they'll be going, oh, that's really cool. And we're hoping they'll do the latter, but you never know. So then after that Friday, we will have our, or not after that Friday, but after the parade, we'll have our homecoming game, where this year we're really trying to emphasize honoring our alumni. And so one of the things you can do is, if you're an alumni, you can buy a ticket online with the Black and Gold Booster Club. And for, I believe, $25 or $35, you get an alumni T-shirt, you get a free barbecue dinner, and you get admission to the football game. And before the football game, at around 6:15 to 6:30, Dr. Prater and I will be honoring the past principals and alumni staff that are currently and previously were on campus. And so we'll be up there on the stage, give them a handshake, give them a T-shirt, and acknowledge them before. We're really trying to put emphasis on everybody coming back. So any students, even if they graduated last year, who want to come back, we're really excited. In fact, when we announce our homecoming king and queen, they'll be announced by the homecoming king and queen from last year. We asked them to come back, and they said they would. So we're really excited about that. And then after that Friday, we're going to have our homecoming dance on Saturday. It's a neon black lights, so we're going to have people, you know, they'll come in a white t-shirt and it'll glow and it's going to be really exciting. We're super stoked about that. And on Thursday, as Eli just reminded me, we have a band that's doing a high school tour just around high schools in California, maybe the nation, Breaking Tempo. They said they would play for free, and any entertainment that's free entertainment is good entertainment. So we're setting them up on Thursday. We checked them out. They're a cool band, so we're excited to have everybody there. And leading us into the next week, we have our Powder Puff game that'll be on Wednesday. So if you want to come, check it out. It'll be that evening. And then that's all of our events that we have lately. I believe that's it. Thank you, guys.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe Eli can answer this question for me. So is this the new newspaper?
Yeah, I believe that came out on Friday.
And Grant, you're under the same dispensation, so okay, it's good.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
So we are now at the 2014-2015 goals recap progress to date.
Thank you, Mr. President and Board. This presentation is not meant to repeat what you've already heard, but rather what this presentation's meant for is to establish a process by which we review what we've covered to date. And so I'd like to bring the board back several years to when you had the foresight to adopt the strategic plan initiatives. Those 10 initiatives were bold, they were fundamentally important to putting in definition, putting forward students and learning as a priority. And so I will say to you, going into our fifth year of working on those initiatives, we've fine-tuned, we continue to figure it out. And I guess that's the best way I can describe it. But I am very pleased at the place in which our district has come and how we have managed to take on some really difficult challenges along the way. I will keep this brief, but I just want you to know that everything I will share with you this evening, you have already seen. It has been a presentation. It has been a report. It has been an update. But I do think it's important that we review each, I would say, trimester, if you will, where we've come from and where we're going next. So that's what this is. But first, what I'd like to do is bring you back to last July, where you adopted the goals for the year. And those goals were anchored to three big priorities. Those three priorities were all means all, improving instruction, and stewardship of resources. I have created just sort of a cliff note version of what those mean. All means all really is about all students learning is important to us as a district. This is our top priority, as it should be. In order for that to happen, we've realized that students must have access to rigorous, engaging courses and electives. We also know that personalized learning is an important criteria as we move into the 21st century, and we'll learn more about that in the coming months. Also, access to technology and counseling and family advocacy, the wellness of our students is critical. Wellness of our students and their families is important in order for students to get the most out of learning. Improving instruction. Kids will not learn if the instruction isn't engaging them, if there isn't a relationship there. Making this very tricky is the advent of Common Core state standards. This has been a game changer, and all of our employees, especially our teachers, are feeling the effects of that change. So we have worked very hard to align our instruction and our curriculum to those Common Core standards. And that's where our focus should be. Also, creating classrooms that are relevant and engaging and interesting 21st century learning classrooms. We need to provide our students with tools for success, and then ultimately, as the board has done with the adoption of the goals, is that STEAM education is one of those things that makes our environments engaging, rigorous, exciting for our kids. And we know that the STEAM fields in particular are in the job and the workforce are becoming more and more relevant as the job and the work fields are shifting. So I think it's a very important piece to what we do. Stewardship of resources. The board, I'm so proud to be a part of this team. You have worked exceptionally hard to balance the budget, to live within your means. In addition to that, to align the LCAP and the budget to the priorities that we're sharing here tonight. And then the biggest thing that's taking up so much of our thoughts and energies is the is our focus on a facility master plan and the corresponding bond campaign, Measure D. And so these are the priorities. These are the things that we're focusing on. But in order to make these priorities relevant to the everyday experience of our principals and teachers, we had to establish goals. So what are those measurable goals? What is it that we tried to do? Well, what we did is we took those three priorities, those big ideas, and we aligned them to three specific categories. One is student success, the other is staff development and support, and the third one is district and board action. So I'd like to just start really quickly what you have seen. This is our data cycle, if you will. What is it that we're seeing under Goal Area 1, student success? Well, you've heard, and we had a presentation on our summer school program this last summer, where we had hundreds of students, our targeted audience in particular, attending summer school. I believe it was highly successful. We also had an opportunity to share our high school advanced placement data, student data, and we're seeing great progress in that area. Illuminate is our new student data system. This will allow all of our teachers, principals, district staff, and you, the board, to be able to track trends in student achievement data, to look at targeted areas of student progress and growth, and make sense of them. This is a really important piece once we become in alignment with the new assessment system, where we'll have meaningful data to look at, and you'll be able to look at it, and it won't be a guesswork. Also, we had a presentation on reading recovery, elementary standards-based report card, and tonight you'll adopt hopefully the single plans for student achievement. Under Goal Area 2, staff development and support, we have transitioned to the Google platform. You will hear more and more about this. This has been, I would say, a difficult transition for those in the office. This has been a welcome enterprise for classroom teachers. The students are using this Google platform. Teachers are using it. We're sharing documents. It's a real fantastic opportunity to share information and to collaborate virtually. Also, we have trained all administrators on the Breakthrough Coach model. We plan on having an additional training January 8th and 9th of 2015. The whole purpose of the Breakthrough Coach, as all of you know, is to get our principals, all of our administrators into the classrooms, become visible, become well-informed, and to be a supportive, well-informed advocate for what's happening in the classrooms. Finally, our professional development model has shifted. Last year, we've heard that teachers were out of the classroom too many days. But we did that because we knew this Common Core transition was going to be difficult. Shifting to the Common Core framework, as well as changing the model in which we teach to the workshop model, was very difficult. This year, we have moved much of our professional development to the site level. So site-based professional development is our focus. We're trying to minimize the number of days teachers are out of their classrooms. And then goal three, district and board actions. Well, what have we done? All elementary schools, middle schools in our district are completely Wi-Fi'd. That's a significant effort by this board to make sure that happened. That will have an impact on student achievement because it changes access to information. More on that to come. We also have held parent education nights on math and report cards. We have introduced, thanks to Mr. Pinkerton's foresight, the 7-year budget plan, which allows us to look beyond the next year and the year after that and make sense of what's coming. Additionally, we've worked on our facility master plan. Our bond campaign is going very well, and Mr. Palazzo, Mr. Pinkerton have brought you up to speed on educating you on the construction and the design process. As if that bond passes, we'll have some running room here on information. Also, the district website has been redone. All the elementary, middle, and high school sites have been redone to align with that. So now we have streamlined information systems across the district, as well as we did our annual report this summer. It's our first annual report to the community. We plan on making that an annual effort. That reached over 25,000 residents this summer. That'll become more important if this bond passes, because we'll have a way to communicate exactly what we're trying to do. We also had boardwalks. Boardwalks, for those that do not know, boardwalks is a scheduled event twice a month where board members are given tours of our schools by the principals, so that board members, independent of the superintendent and district staff, get an opportunity to go through classrooms with the principals and see for themselves what's happening. It's a great opportunity. Also, we've done our LCAP implementation. This is our implementation year, and we're very excited about what we're finding. So what do we have around the corner? March 3rd is our next second progress update. You can expect those items that are up there, of which you'll begin to see as the year progresses, you will begin to see student achievement data. You'll begin to see what seems to be working for kids and what seems to be a challenge for them. You'll also hear from teachers. You'll begin to see these things emerge and make sense. So stay tuned. There's more to come. We're excited about where this is going, and I will continue to keep you in the loop in terms of how we're doing with our goals. Any questions?
I just have a quick comment.
Mr. Millar.
I was very pleased to see the goals articulated in the single plan for student achievements. It has a symmetry that is very professional, very appropriate, and I also noticed that the way the board had the presentations made to it and the order that Dr. Prater just went through was really helpful, and I just think that the view from 30,000 feet is this is a really well put together goal setting and goal implementation process, and I really appreciate it.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
And just in a few words, can you explain the main difference or the main feature of Illuminate as a student data service?
I'll try my best. We transitioned from Data Director, and Illuminate is really the next generation of how data it can be utilized in a one-house shop. So with Data Director, it had probably more limitations as to what you could generate in terms of reports. Illuminate is far more comprehensive. It allows reports to be to come alive. It allows you to access individual student data within groups. So I guess in the short and sweet of it is it's a much more robust system that allows teachers, principals, administrators from the district to have common conversations about what's really happening.
Can I just add one feature that I've just learned about doing some classroom observations is there's actually a data bank, a bank of assessment types of questions that teachers can use on the fly that are all Common Core aligned and grade level aligned within Illuminate. So teachers can actually create, you know, 3-question check for understanding types of assessments that they can give to students that are aligned to the Common Core, which is really a nice feature that then they can also get those reports, get that data. So it's beyond just a database system. It actually has a data set itself of assessment material. So pretty powerful.
And then is that like a K-12 or?
My understanding is I'm getting nods back there, K-12. I've seen it at the elementary
K-12 level.
I've seen it at the elementary level and here at Los Osos Middle School. They've used it quite a bit in their sixth grade program.
Okay.
And one last thing I'd like to add that I've learned just last week is that, because they gave me a test run on how it works. And when I say they, Darla Batistic and Aaron Lunds, what I learned was that the elementary report card through Illuminate will download information, student information data, onto the report cards automatically, so teachers don't have to do it. So it becomes a powerful interface that actually saves time. Now, I will tell you, it sounds great, but I'm sure the kinks will be there and there will be frustrations, as we all know. But give us a year, and we're going to figure this out, and we will be able to figure out all the gadgets, and it will be phenomenal as a tool for teachers to enhance their understanding and convey their understanding to students and parents and one another.
Mr. Unger.
Well, I would thank you, and one thing I would like to see is when we get this up and running and everybody's comfortable with it, I'd love to have a board presentation on its implementation and the public access to the data that you're talking about. I think that would be very cool for us to understand. A mini study session of sorts is, I think, what I'm asking for.
It's actually a board presentation that's scheduled, I believe, in January.
Any further questions, comments? Thank you very much, Dr. Prater.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are now at the part of the agenda for public input and correspondence. I don't see any. So we are now open for public comment. So anyone who wishes to address the board on any issue or any item on the agenda, if you wish to to address us on the item on the agenda, you can wait until that time if you wish, or you can address us now. And seeing no one coming forward, I'm going to close public comment. And trying to go by my script here. We are on the new order of business, so we are going to have the construction planning process part deux.
Well done.
Hey, we.
So last time I quickly kind of went through with the board the initial aspect of the construction planning where we talked about the design aspect of selecting architects, site facility committees. We also discussed planning, which included phasing, scope of work. And then I briefly kind of touched on implementation, so which was cash flow model, budgeting, project delivery. And so Anthony's going to kind of take it to the next step. I can't tell you how fortunate I feel we are as a district to have Anthony in the role that he is going to, play for us. And I think you're going to see that tonight as he proceeds to talk about these items. And again, the hope is really to educate the board tonight on the process, the planning. You know, we will be coming back to you should the bond pass with much more specific steps, guidance, those types of things. And really, hopefully, answer any questions that you may have in terms of construction process and those types of things. So I'm going to have Anthony go ahead and deliver this presentation.
Great. Good evening, members of the board, President Quisenberry, the guys on the right. thanks for having me here tonight. I'm going to try and still keep it up at 30,000 feet at this level, but we will kind of dive into the weeds occasionally as we get into some of the details of things. I think, as Ryan said, the most important thing to keep in mind here is that we are starting to think as a business department and as a facilities department about all these different elements that we're going to have to start implementing should the bond pass. But I also want to just make it clear that even if the bond doesn't pass, we're still going to have construction work that needs to be done, and all of these things still need to be done as good practice, being good stewards of the resources, putting good policies and procedures in place, checks and balances in terms of, you know, as we're hiring people and as we're working with different vendors in different capacities. The delta really would just be how many zeros are after the dollar amounts in the projects. Are we having a lot of small projects if the bond doesn't pass? Are we having a lot more larger projects if it does? So that's really going to be the delta. The practices, the principles, the procedures that we're going to talk about are really the same. Okay? Kind of, we called it our construction. If we can go to the next slide, please. We're calling this Construction 201 without any text. So, oh, there it goes. Okay, perfect. These are kind of the high points we're going to talk about today. And these are kind of some of the key elements moving forward that we need to start putting processes and procedures in place for making these things happen. Basically, all of these are kind of the big areas, if you will, that we need to be addressing as we move forward with projects. So we'll go to the, I won't read these to you, you guys can read them, we'll kind of get going. If we can go to the next slide, please. So, one of my favorite topics, working with architects. Thank you. So working with architects, oh, here we're back, okay, that's okay, we'll keep moving. You know, at the end of the day, as we kind of go through all of this, one thing to keep in mind is the architect is typically the first vendor, consultant, the first person that or entity that we'll be bringing on to get projects started, and they're going to be with us throughout the whole process from the very early inception all the way till the day we're, you know, opening the doors and cutting the ribbon. It's really important. They really serve as our quarterback or lead off pitcher, as it may be, if we're talking the appropriate time, for our projects. And we really need to rely on them as such and select firms that sort of behave in that manner, that kind of have that attitude and have that as part of their culture. And that's typically firms that have worked in the school business before, have experience working with districts. That's part of their culture, those types of things. They really do serve as our eyes and ears and our advocate, if you will, throughout the entire process. We hire them directly in most of the scenarios that you'll see. They are under contract directly with the district, and they are an independent set of eyes that's looking out for our best interests. They're going to help us get through the agency approval process, whether it be local agency reviews with health departments or fire marshals or things like that, also with the state at the state level, and then also at any of the county levels in terms of health department and such. And then they will help us all through the construction process as well, working with the contractor to get the project built. But I just kind of want to craft it in the context of that, you know, they are the first domino that needs to fall. They are the first person that we need to get moving on our projects to get the ball rolling. We currently have the RFQ out. It's been issued sort of out on the wire, if you will. There's quite a few RFQ holders, if you will, that are on the list that have it's been sent to. They're due early next week. The interviews will be late next week, and we'll probably be making some decisions in the following week after that. We have set up a process based on the RFQ that there'll be a screening committee. They'll paper screen the submittals that come in. They'll make a recommendation to an interview committee. That committee then will make recommendations to the board for accepting a pool of architects that'll help execute our projects. One of the things I think that's important is we also don't want to just hire like one firm to do all of our work. It would probably be very difficult. They may not have the expertise in all the different things we need. We want to put a pool together and pick the right firm to execute our projects as we're moving forward of our pool of architects. So we may pick a few different firms that have a few different characteristics or expertise or areas of interest that would play out for our projects as a whole. So, and feel free to ask any questions as we're going along here.
Anthony?
Sir.
Walt. So these would be contingent on Measure D passing, the architect selection.
I think the number of firms we might put in our pool may be sort of contingent on Measure D, but I think it would be wise as a district to have a pool of firms that we can go to when we do need even small projects, like putting Teach together or you know, renovating a restroom or needing an ADA upgrade somewhere. So I think it would be wise. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, I think that's a good idea. I just want to kind of make it clear for me and for the public that we wouldn't be actually entering in contracts with these architects until we knew that Measure D passed.
No, that's a very good point. Thank you, Walt, for bringing that up. This is really establishing our pool. And then once projects are prioritized, they're assigned a budget, they're assigned a scope from the district side, then we will start to issue those projects out to our architects. But this process of selecting can take a couple months just to get that rolling.
Okay.
So that's excellent. We want to get ahead of that is what I'm trying to, what we're trying to do at
thank
this
you.
Point. So thank you. Okay.
I just had a quick question on that.
Yes.
This committee to review the applications is made up of whom?
This would be some district staff, possibly some teachers. I think Ryan and I are going to meet on Friday and establish that first committee. That would be the screening committee. The interview committee we've loosely established is going to be district administration staff. We've got an outside consultant that we're working with that does this kind of statewide and a site principal.
Okay. And then can I ask you a question, Anthony?
Yes, of course.
One thing I'm curious about, too, is I can see the coordination of everything being complicated, and it seems to me, since we're so dependent on the architects to be able to, as you say, quarterback the jobs, how do we set up within our district that oversight, that management oversight, when we have several games going on at the same time? And that seems to me to be something that's going to be complicated that we're going to need to pay a lot of attention to.
We've got the league commissioner sitting over there. We've got a couple of the general managers that will be working in our department and a couple of the coaches as well. So I think we'll talk a little bit about some of the next steps in a later slide. And if I don't get to your question, then can you hold that one? Okay, because that's a really good question. Yes. Oh, sorry, Mr. Buckman. Okay. Yeah, but I'll kind of talk a little bit more about project management on the last slide, if you will. Okay. All right. So once we get the architect on board, once we get the designs done, we've got our input from the sites, we've developed a full set of plans, we've established that our scope and our budget are in alignment, the architect has done their magic. We need to go get our agency approvals. And this is our building permit, okay? You guys have probably heard of the Division of the State Architect, or the DSA. Historically, looking back in the records, the district has done a lot of smaller projects. The DSA has been sort of a smaller piece of it, a lot of relocatables. It's a simple process. As we move forward and we get into more complicated projects, renovating Building 100 at the high school, for example, or new pools, or getting in and gutting out the old annex building at Slow High and turning that into something new, we're going to start spending a lot more time at DSA than just putting down several classrooms here and there or doing a landscaping project, if you will. So we need to get a real jump on the DSA approvals and start to, get our architect on board, get the DSA on the team, work with architects that work well with the DSA, have a good track record with them, and get that process rolling. Because that process alone, just getting from the day we turn it in to the day it's approved and we're ready to start construction, can be 6 to 18 months just sitting at the DSA's, on the DSA's desk. So we want to make sure we're working with these other departments simultaneously so that we're going in and getting our health department approvals. If we have pools, we've got to work with the county health department. If we've got kitchens, we've got to work with the health department. We've got the strong potential of some coastal commission input on Morro Bay High, depending on what our projects start to roll out like.
Can I ask a quick question on
this? Yes, sir.
So I understand with the DSA, getting it out there ahead of time, and I guess the question is, that same approach maybe with the Coastal Commission, is that what I'm hearing? Because sometimes it's, a little plant this big, and it could take months.
Yeah, one of the key things is as we start to lay out our priorities on each of the sites, and we start to, and we'll be doing this before the end of the year, quite honestly, is we will start bringing on some consultants that will help us with some of these specifics, like at Coastal Commission. That's going to be a unique one. And start getting that planning process with Coastal Commission going right away. They won't get into the minutia of, the actual inside the building per se, but they're going to definitely have a lot to say about square footage and things like that. If it's a new building or if it's an addition of the construction. A lot of the renovations and things, it's a little less impactful in terms of the Coastal Commission's input. Okay. The other piece, too, and I just want to touch on this real quickly, is also keeping in mind that we still need to work with the OPSC or the Office of Public School Construction. They are, you know, still a player in this game, as there's a state bond that still could potentially be out there. They still have state money that is being doled out. We have eligibility. We're working with Julie Avenant at Spectrum Management Solutions. She's helping us identify other funding sources. So we've got to keep them on our radar as a player and as an agency that we need to work with. And simultaneously, we need to work with the California Department of Ed. In order to get funded at the state, we need to have Department of Ed approval. So kind of all three of these other agencies and these other four agencies, if you will, we need to have those happening simultaneously while we're working with the DSA. And again, having our architects be aware of that and then they're familiar with this process is really important. Okay? We'll keep going. And I know we want to get moving tonight. So I thought we would talk a little bit about some of the delivery methods. And I'm not going to advocate for one over the other or sort of say one's better than the other. Really, tonight, I just want to talk about sort of some of the decisions we'll want to start making in the next few months as we move forward. Because, as you'll see, some of these delivery methods have the contractor involved early on. So as we get our architects moving, we need, if we're going to go one or two of these routes, we would need to make that decision and get our contractor on board. The three methods that are sort of prevalent right now in the K-12 arena are design-build, design-bid-build, and our lease-leaseback delivery model. Okay, and I'll go into each of these different models here a little bit more in depth. But I think the important thing to keep in mind is that we need to evaluate each of the projects or each of the sites for its appropriateness for the type of delivery method. For example, some types of projects, roofing, painting, they lend themselves really well to design, bid, build because it's fairly simple. It's kind of commodity-based. You can get, you know, good pricing. Some more complicated projects that are very detailed, detailed phasing, moving of students, timing, might lend itself better to a design build or a lease back because you have more control over the contractor and when things can happen, and you have that contractor working with you during design to kind of make sure that's all going to happen. So I just, you know, again, that's what we need to evaluate each of those project types or delivery methods for the project type that we have. Okay, the first is design build. And basically, in a nutshell, it's you hire one entity to design and build your project. Okay, so you will hire either, you know, we just kind of use the term developer, but you will hire a development entity to bring in an architect, bring in the engineers, bring in the construction teams, bring in all the different players to design and build the project for one price, and we'll call that $100. And they're going to hire everybody to do that project. The good side of it is you're dealing with one person. The downside of it also is that you're dealing with one person. There's not that separation between the architect, the contractor, that and kind of that checks and balances. Now, it really lends itself well to large projects that are sort of new, clean slates, like Cal Poly's using it for the new dorms project. You know, that's $200-something million. It's a long process. It's a clean site. It lends itself well to that. It won't lend itself well to a $100,000 project for the Teach parking lot. So it's kind of one of those things where we have to think about sort of the upside and the downside of just hiring one entity, kind of being locked into that and not having some of those checks and balances in terms of you know, the architect being the advocate, if you will, for the district. The architect now would work for the contractor or the development entity and, you know, potentially would be making decisions that way. I'm not saying they do. I'm just saying there can be that potential. So that's design build. Any questions on that one? Okay. It's fairly straightforward. It's not so common in K-12. It's more common community college, university. It is available to us. It's in the regulations as a allowed method, but it's not as common in K-12 just because of the types of projects we have. The second is design bid build, which is our traditional. We hire an architect. They do a set of plans. It goes out for public bid. The person on bid day that's got the lowest price with a bond, a B license, and probably a dog in a truck is the winner of the project, okay? I hate to simplify it that, but that's in essence what the how the process works. You know, the upsides
so
of that.
So the bond, the bond is a surety bond that they'll complete the project, and if not, then the bond is forfeited to us.
Correct, correct. And all and of these... go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, in a lot of those situations, the bond recipients really aren't made whole because of lost opportunity, delays in getting things done, stuff like that. Is that kind of check with your experience?
Oh, yeah. It behooves us to have a reputable contractor that's financially sound, develop our projects and get them completed and not get into working with a bonding company.
Okay.
That's there as a safeguard to keep us whole as we can, but it there's a huge, like you said, there's a huge opportunity lost if we had to go that route. A lot of this, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the selection, is set up so that we don't ever get into that spot. But that's one of the pitfalls of a design bid build. It's anybody that's got, meets those criteria can bid on our project, and even if they've never even built a school, you know, historically they've been able to win projects if they're the lowest on bid day. Yes.
Under those circumstances, would the project just be put out to a select bid list, or are you saying it would be go out to everybody who can access
historically, it's been a public low bid. So anyone with a valid contractor's license, the ability to bond the project, and the wherewithal and the financial resources to bond that project, we're eligible to bid. Now, there's some changes in the law that have just taken effect that we'll talk about actually on the next slide, that now we are required to start pre-qualifying contractors. But again, and I was just at a seminar today, it's fairly ambiguous right now as to where you kind of can draw that line and what sort of criteria you can actually hold. It's really just, it's more of a process that we'll have to work with Lozano Smith, our attorney, to actually, you know, get a solid vetting process of that. But they are moving away from that. Just anyone can bid now. You do have to get pre-qualified.
Okay.
You jumped me ahead a little bit, Mr. Rogers.
Sorry.
But that's okay. That's okay.
Anthony.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair. What I might have heard just now is the lowest bidder, and it's my understanding the district does not have to take the lowest bidder if there's other considerations or reasons to do that, or do we by law have to accept the lowest bid?
It's very difficult to determine the low. It has to be very specific sort of discrepancies in their bid documents or specific actions that you cannot take them. You know, but that's why I say, and I kind of generalize that tongue in cheek with, you know, if you got a valid license, a bond, a dog, and a truck, you can bid on it.
Okay. I have a dog and a truck.
Okay, but we just need you to get that valid. Well, if you're a board member, you actually can't bid on it. But no, that in all seriousness, that's historically how the design bid build has operated, and it's been who's kind of guesses, you know, best, and it's usually, it's not as linear as a process as you might think, and it's not as well thought out because you don't have the contractor who's ultimately going to be building it giving input during the design process. So that's one of the downfalls of it. A lot of the private sector, they don't build that way. You know, they will usually have the contractor selected, help the architect with how something can get built, and then, you know, work on the pricing once the scope is finalized. So that's how private sector works, and that's a little bit more about as we get into lease back. It's kind of a pseudo hybrid or a quasi hybrid of design build and design bid build. You know, one of the nice things about the lease back is you select your contractor up front, you have them on board as part of the team working in a pre-construction services arrangement, working with the architect and the district to ensure that the scope, the budget, and the desired outcomes are being met by all parties. And so they're getting involved early, and it really does help when you're in a project like you're trying to do surgery on a high school campus and move 350 students around as we're renovating their classroom wings in the middle of winter. Having the contractor on board as that's being designed and giving input on how the design can go, because remember, once the architect designs it, it gets approved at the DSA, it's very difficult to make big changes, and we got to go all the way back through DSA again, 6 to 18 months. So having that done right the first time, going through DSA once, having it all figured out, there's a huge benefit to that, especially when we're on an operating campus or an active campus. You know, one of the concerns with it is how do we know we're getting best value in our price? And so we have to put some stop measures in there to make sure that the contractor is bidding the project out to subcontractors, making sure we set our overhead and profit numbers so that they're equal for all the contractors, and the contractor knows what their overhead and profit will be, and their general conditions will be up front. So this takes the guesswork out of that. We kind of, this is your fee. You know, you're going to get X percentage of the total bid amount from all the subs. That's your fee, Mr. and Mrs. Contractor. So we kind of set those things. We set those rules up front. As they're working on it, they agree to it or they don't agree to it. You know, and then that's if they don't agree, we, you know, get someone on the list who's qualified that will agree to that. But we usually lay that all out as we get as we're selecting our firms and make sure they're in agreement with that up front. So, you know, the difference is you're selecting your firm based on their qualifications and their value. You're using an RFQ process. You're using a pre-qualification process. You're looking at their experience, you're looking at their financial soundness, you're looking at their past history, you know, checking references, things like that. Things you can't necessarily do in a design bid build low bid arena as well when you're doing the sort of the pre-qualification. Okay, am I hitting all the high spots so far? Okay. So those are kind of the three things, and we'll be bringing back, be talking a little more in depth with those as we start to actually get the projects developed and start to put our pool of potential builders together, whether it be pre-qualification for design bid build, design build, or even lease back. We kind of have to go through those steps regardless of which one of the delivery methods we would be involved with. So talking about contractors specifically, the state now requires us for projects over $1 million to have our key sub-trades and our general contractors to be pre-qualified. So we'll be working with our legal team to put that package together. They have some great templates, and we've been working with a lot of their templates in terms of their contracts and some of their RFQ models. And we'll be, you know, putting that package together and starting to issue that if and when the bond passes. Let's be positive. If the bond passes, and getting that out there to start getting our pool of contractors put together too. At the same time, we've got other vendors that we'll need to be engaging the services of, and so we'll use a similar process, maybe slightly simplified because some of their services aren't as intricate or technical, but we'll need to have inspectors on board, we'll have to have testing labs, we'll have equipment and furniture suppliers, some specialty suppliers, we'll have environmental consultants possibly involved, and they'll be handling Coastal Commission and things like that. And we've probably got a few other small and incidental consultants that'll be out there that we'll need to pull in. But those will be some of the other people and parties that we'll need to bring in, and we'll kind of use a similar vetting process, if you will, where we'll get paper submittals, we'll have a screening team, we'll have a selection committee with the interviews, and then we'll make recommendations to the board to move forward with those entity or entities. Okay? Yes, sir.
For the purposes of this project, Lozano Smith is going to be acting as our attorneys for this. It sounds like so far it's Lozano, is that correct?
So far for the construction aspect
for this, for this, for this, the phase we're in right now.
Yeah, so for the construction, template planning, those types of things, yes. Should the bond pass, and in terms of that, that would be Jones Hall would deal with the actual bond and bond revenues and phase, you know, those types of things. But for the most part, yeah, we've been dealing with Lozano Smith for construction planning templates documents.
Yeah. Okay. So a little bit of preliminarily how this will roll out. One of the things that's very critical as a facilities department, as a business department, as a district to be watching is how is this money rolling in. The first thing we want to do is go out and design $177 million worth of work and then think we're going to build it in year two. It's just not going to happen. So we've been working on sort of a cash flow model, and these are some of the preliminary numbers that, that John Isom has given in terms of how they're projecting it to be the cash to be coming in. Okay, we're taking this and we're putting this into a long range model that's going to show, you know, as this cash hits, as some of the projects that we've been prioritized preliminarily, how they would actually roll out, what their cost is, and sort of overlaying those with time as the cash is coming in, making sure that that as the projects will hit, as they'll get through DSA, as they'll, you know, hit the summer, June months are typically when we like to start a lot of these projects, not always, but that's, it's desirable. You know, every June, will we have the cash to start rolling these projects out? It's really critical to know this up front, or at least have a very good idea of how this is going to work, so that we don't get stuck with a lot of projects in the drawer and then no cash to build them. We want to phase our design work, because our DSA approval takes some time, but it also expires. We don't want to design something today that we won't build for 7 years, because that's money, that's just opportunity loss. We, you know, we want to design that at the appropriate time. We want to get it through as soon as we can, but we don't want to design it too early either, because codes do change and drawings do expire if we don't start construction. We typically have 4 years to start construction on a DSA-approved project. So from the day we get DSA approval, we've got 4 years to break ground and sign contracts. So we're starting to put together a model with Julie Avenant. She's helping us with our cash flow and sort of our phasing analysis, and she's really an integral part of this piece of it as she starts to really help us with managing the money side of it on a big scale. And again, this is very preliminary right now. So, you know, the market could change tomorrow. Things could happen. But again, we have the tool now. We'll have the tool to react to that as it happens. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, could I ask a quick question?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Meyer.
Okay. Anthony, it sounds like cash flow and project flow, for lack of a better term, is really going to drive the bond issues more so than changes in the dynamics of the bond market. Is that pretty accurate?
I'm sorry, I missed that question.
Walter, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, so he...
it sounds like the cash flow and managing the flow of the projects are going to be more important than changes in the bond market. And the reason I'm asking is because, of course, you know, the Fed is ultimately going to change policies, and there's going to be an increase in interest rates, which, of course, changes the yield for bonds and the price of bonds. But it sounds to me like those differences are kind of dwarfed by the need to maintain cash flow and to keep projects flowing. That's my question.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that that's a good assessment of that. You know, the other piece of it is having it laid out up front, and if something were to happen or the market were to change or something, you know, like we saw in the last 10 years, if assessed valuation all of a sudden dropped off the face like it did before, we can then react to it. We've got time. We've got it figured out, and we can say, hey, you know, we can now do steps A, B, and C to sort of mitigate this problem.
Okay.
But at least we now know what we're faced with, and then we have, you know, we'll have options as opposed to getting caught flat-footed, so to speak.
And so two things I'll add to that, and that is once we receive the bond funds, we have to expend them within 3 years.
Yeah.
So that's critical to know that. And two, this also outlines the fact that as we plan, we need to make sure that our top priorities are getting done, right? That the board's priorities, that those things that we've established, that as we lay out this project delivery, that we're making sure that those top priorities are getting completed, I would say.
So I think that goes to my question and to the dollars here. Not sure we're going to get anything real soon from the state in terms of matching funds and a new building, you know, proposition to give money to public schools to build. But if it were to happen and we've already had our bond approval and we've already started to spend money, does that preclude us from getting matching funds?
Okay, no.
So we can step in.
How we will kind of use it as a tool, it's a good question because it you know, how does it actually play into the whole scheme of things? You know, if we were going to go on a 50-50, if we were, you know, passing this bond for 177 and getting 177 from the state, I'd be much more concerned about the state component of it. Since the state component's really a small part of this. 6 to 8 million is what we're kind of looking at from the construction state modernization and growth grants, and potentially a few million more from some other funds. It's not a huge cash burden, if you will, in this model. It will show up in one of the fiscal years as we kind of move down the line. And when we have the cash flow model kind of built in the next few weeks, and we'll share that with you, you'll kind of see, like, if we anticipate a 16 bond, we'll say, all right, if there's a 16 bond, that cash will probably hit mid-17, and we'll show that on the cash model. And then when we get to 16, if that cash doesn't look like it's going to show up in 17 and it's out to 2020, then we just move it out there, and we'll plan accordingly in those next 3 years. But because it's such a small amount, relatively speaking, right now, it's not going to play as much into the cards. Now, if all of a sudden we're going to start seeing some more aging facilities, we're going to still start applying for that, and we'll start to look at how that affects us.
Okay, so in my mind, there's the possibility that in days gone by when the state would actually put up money and you would match it with your bond money. Mm-hmm. And so if you put up $20, the state would match and get $40. We've put up to the public $177. If there were matching dollars available, we could either, this is the question, could we either reduce what we put out on the bond market, or could we look for matching dollars for major projects, not to just the remodernization?
What we will be eligible for is modernization at a couple key sites, and we had shared those with you prior, and it was
That's now money. I'm talking about future.
Yeah, we're going to start projecting future money here fairly shortly.
Okay. I'll talk to you.
Okay. But basically what it does is let's just say we're eligible for $20 million total in state grant, and we have to put $20 million up. We're going to go pick projects, and that's that tier three level of projects that we're going to do we're going to do $40 million in that tier three. And then if we get our state match, that'll refund our bond money, so to speak. That's kind of how it functionally works in districts, if to simplify it. And then it becomes bond money again.
Okay. So critical, as Anthony said, with the OPSC, that as we do projects and renovations, that we make sure that we have our paperwork in, and mm-hmm. so that should a state bond pass in the future and there are funds available, we will have been in line to get those back. So we will be doing that throughout this process.
Yeah, and the other thing the state's looking at right now, and this will start to – I'm getting down in the weeds. I apologize, guys. I apologize, Marilyn. but we're getting into the weeds, but – you know, relocatables are going to start to become a huge component of the new state program if it does roll out. Are you modernizing relocatables, or are you taking those funds and then you're getting to build new facilities? And that's the state's moving in that direction. They've made that push. Again, we've got to pass a state bond before it even becomes reality, but you know, then we start to assess, do we put money into our relocatables, do we remove them and then get to rebuild new facilities? You know, we've got to start having those conversations and start thinking about that, and that'll start to craft how we actually roll out some of our projects. Do we want to start taking relos off? Well, maybe it behooves us to keep them on for a little while longer because they may become eligible for some state money. So starting to think about those things is in terms of this cash flow model and where that cash might hit from the state. Prop 39 is another funding source. I just was speaking with the local U.S. Green Building Council, USGBC, the local chapter, about some drought mitigation grants that are now available from the state, you know, to the tune of we could have a tune of some six-figure numbers from the state for some drought mitigation. So starting to look at some of those types of funding sources that are other than just our typical state historical growth and modernization grants. So, again, this is really the first pass. We'll be watching this very closely with Mr. Isom as we move forward and as we start to release bonds. But in all reality, the first release will probably be in the spring of next year. It'd be at the earliest, that by the time we get all the paperwork done and they go through the process of releasing or selling the bonds, it'll probably be April-ish. May-ish is when probably the earliest we would see the first dollars hitting the bank. Okay. And then finally, how will we kind of start to to move these projects out or deliver these projects internally from a management standpoint. You know, one of the things that as we develop our cash flow model with Spectrum Management Solutions is, you know, when will the bulk of our construction work really hit? You know, we'll probably, it'll kind of be a bell curve. That's probably how it'll look. Seems like everything works on a bell curve. There'll be a lot of upfront work. It'll kind of wane a little bit, and then all of a sudden there'll be a bunch of construction work, and then that'll start to drop off. And that'll probably go over the course of 5 to 7 years, possibly 8 or 9, depending on how some of those later bond issuance goes. So, you know, we kind of need to staff and or manage the projects appropriately. A couple of the things we're looking at right now, and we're starting to assess internally as we start to build the model is, you know, do we work with an outside management company or do we kind of do some of the work in-house and put together an in-house team, or do we kind of use a hybrid model of the two? You know, and there's pros and cons to both models. You know, the upside of working with an outside entity is you kind of just hire them and they come in and do it. The downside is there's a cost to that. You know, it's they're taking the risk. They're putting their people here. They've got overhead. They've got, you know, doors to open and lights to keep on, etc. So they've got to cover that cost. You know, so that would be like bringing in an outside project management firm. They come in, they set up shop in the district, they give us, you know, they bring the staff, they bring the procedures, they bring the processes, and they just handle things. You know, we're a part of that team, but, you know, for the most part, you'd kind of outsource a lot of the heavy lifting to them. Conversely, you know, the districts, you know, more recently have kind of moved away a little bit from that and kind of started to build in-house teams. You know, you're going to have a 5 to 7 year construction program. The model could be that you do it in-house and you start to hire some key people to come in and serve as project managers. You know, fortunately, the district has been able to acquire some talent in the construction industry. And that's my cue to get going. So, but... Sorry, Walter. Ryan just walked behind me. So, but it does help reduce our cost. It gives us a little more control over the folks that we're working with, and it does kind of set up a little less of an extra cook in the kitchen, so to speak. It's more that starts to become more that district architect contractor as opposed to sort of four entities working on the project. We've seen some models where some districts have kind of done it as an in-house project management process, but they've used an outside contractor to just give them staff instead of bringing the whole team, to the district. So there's kind of a hybrid model of that. I think Atascadero is kind of using that right now. I know that Santa Barbara Unified is using that right now. So there's a couple different ways to kind of go about these two different delivery methods. These are sort of the two traditional models, if you will, and now they've kind of developing that hybrid. But basically what it is you'll have district project managers or you'll have outside project managers that'll each be assigned a certain number of projects, and they'll be responsible for working with the architect and the contractor and ensuring that the projects are brought in on time, on budget. You know, they're looking at any changes in scope that need to be addressed, looking at how the money's being spent, making sure that what's being built is what was ultimately in our education specifications and is our desired outcome. And again, whether you hire that out or you have that in-house, you know, that's really that project manager's role, is overseeing the project. And when Ryan and I worked together at LucMR, they did it all in-house. And then they sort of morphed it over time, and they did bring an outside vendor in as they sort of kind of downsized the construction department internally as people kind of left and the project started to wane off. So, again, you know, there's different ways to kind of handle that, but these are kind of the two main ways that we could look at it, and then, again, kind of that hybrid model. So with that was a little more time than I know.
I just have one quick question.
Yes.
When you talk about architectural services, I don't see any mention of structural engineering, civil engineering. Would that come in under the architect?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I apologize. I use the term architect in a broad breath. What we've put in the RFQ is that the architect will bring their structural engineer, their mechanical engineer, their plumbing, all their different consultants as part of their team. But we only hire, in most projects, we will hire the architect And that's the one contract we have, and then they hire those subcontractors, or those sub-consultants, if you will. So when I say architect, it's that whole team.
Okay, and thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Did I hit all the high spots?
Good. Thank you, Mr. Plaza.
All right, thank you.
Very informative, and I appreciate the work you put into making it accessible and understanding and understandable.
So just to close really quick, you know, my job is to make sure that processes are put in place so that there's not issues, there's not problems. There's been a lot of issues in certain districts throughout the state in terms of bond sales and the way that they've done things. And so I am making sure that we're following the correct steps throughout the process. You know, the district hasn't hired a bond underwriter yet. I'm going to kind of myself, Mr. Isom, we have an outside advocate. We have other people as well that are going to be looking at kind of the big picture to give us advice. And kind of make sure that we're following the steps that we need to take, that we're transparent, and for me, that we're being good stewards of taxpayer funds, and that we are getting the biggest bang for our buck, right? That we're doing the most we can with the dollars we receive. So that's this is kind of the start of the process that Anthony has begun, and we will be coming back to the board with more specific recommendations as it unfolds.
Mr. President?
Yes, Mr. Millar.
I really appreciate the board allowing us to change the agenda. I wanted to hear that presentation. It was very helpful. And with your indulgence, I'm going to let my able colleagues handle a little the rest of the agenda, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Millar, and we appreciate the trust that you place in all of us.
Thank you all for letting me telephone in again. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Walt. All right.
All right.
Okay, I think Walter has left the building. Yes. All right, we are now on item 7.01, which is the business and budget update.
So, yeah, just a couple quick items. We kind of a big deal in the Senate in California. Kevin DeLeon, Democrat from Los Angeles, took over as the Speaker pro tem, and so that was, you know, kind of a change of leadership in the Democratic Party, and it's going to be interesting in the election to see kind of who is elected and how that changes, and that may have effect in terms of politics in California in the coming years. Overall, the economy itself is up, so revenue, sales tax, corporate income tax, So the economy is moving along. They're seeing home prices continue to increase. And so those are positive signs for the California economy, which is always good for education, hopefully, in the budget. And then lastly, it was kind of an interesting thing in SF Squared. They talked a little bit about the Census Bureau put out kind of a supplemental index about poverty in the state. So I don't know if you saw that, but it basically that 25% of Californians are living at the poverty level. And so that has lots of different implications, as we know, and effects on kids and effects on families. And so I think that's something that we're seeing more so even in our own communities here and the effects that it has. And so that's why it's so important for us to have those board goals and priorities that we've set to make sure that we're meeting the needs of our students. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. All right, we are now moving on to the resolutions. We'll open that now. Dr. Prater, are you ready to start with this?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
So this resolution, 8.01, this resolution has to do with opposing the legislative cap on local fiscal reserves. To remind the board, this was Senate Bill 857, where it was really a trailer bill that slipped in at the last minute right before the budget was adopted. It's a complex situation in that it's predicated on the passage of Proposition 2, which is the Rainy Day Fund. It is not something that will help basic aid districts in particular, because while the local control funding formula, we don't receive any of those funds. The whole premise behind it is that local control is a value, is a priority. What SB 857 essentially says is that it will limit the local governance team's abilities to decide on what their reserves should look like, and it puts a cap on it. What this resolution says, in effect, is that they would want to repeal or substantially change the language contained in Section 27 of SB 858, which has to do with capping the reserves. So this resolution is in front of you that we would then submit to our legislators.
Thank you, Dr. Prater. Mr. Unger.
Sure. I just really want to thank the board for bringing this proposed resolution forward. I think it is important that we take a stand on this issue. I think especially for San Luis Coastal, it's important for us to maintain healthy reserves to protect our kids, to protect our communities, and to protect our employees. As the resolution points out, we do depend on our reserves to maintain cash flow. We only get our money twice a year, and so we have to find ways to bridge the receivables that we have, and one of the ways we do that is through our reserves. So it's very important for our employees that we pay them. I mean, I think everybody admits that. Everybody understands that. Also, as we have seen, because we're a basic aid school district, and because we're a basic aid school district for the sole reason that we have a nuclear power plant in our backyard, The volatility of the nuclear industry, I think, and the value of the nuclear power plant makes our revenues, I think, less stable than other basic aid school district, other community-funded school districts. We do see right now that there are discussions among various parties about whether to relicense the plant or not. And frankly, if the plant isn't relicensed, then our property taxes will take a hit, or if something happens with PG&E. As we saw in 2000, when we closed three schools, laid off employees, lost 10% of our budget within 6 years, and we vowed that we would never let that happen again. Mrs. Roger was really pushed the notion of a 10% reserve, which we have kept because we understand how that protects people. I think this is The Senate bill is a terrible idea, and I applaud our district for moving forward and sending a message to really our community that we value local control, that we value financial stability, we value our employees and our communities and our students. I think it's really important, and I think we need to make sure that our legislators understand that Senator Monning, who did vote yes on putting that trailer bill language in this package, understands the depth of our feeling on this. I know Assemblyman Asajian does support the repeal of this, and I applaud him for that. I think we need to make sure that if the board chooses to approve this, that we send copies to the California School Boards Association so that they can present this to the governor and his staff. I'd also like to see this sent out to the Tribune and other news sources as well, so they can see that we have taken a stand on this, I think, very important issue of local control, subsidiarity, all the things that the governor is really preached, and now we need to make sure that we continue to hold him to his promises. So I don't know if there's going to be discussion on this, but I would move approval of resolution number 01031415.
I'll second, and then...
Yes, and Mr. Buckman, you can comment now.
Thank you.
So we have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Buckman, and Mr. Buckman, continue.
Thank you. Chris did touch on this in a great summary of I think, probably, definitely my opinion on what we need. And I want to come back to two things that the governor's done and the words that he used to get some of his... babies, his projects through the assembly. One was the local control funding formula, and that was to be local districts would have control through the funding formula. The second thing was the local control accounting plan, the LCAP, and that starts with local again. And the premise is the districts understand best what they need for their own communities. And what is happening at the state, where they're going to try to cap our reserves and tell us how to use our money, is not local control and is not what's going to be best for our students. And I am disappointed in the governor for basically manipulating the legislature one way and then turning around and having us lose control on the other hand. So I strongly support this resolution.
Are there any further comments or questions from the board? If not, I'm going to open this to the public comment. Is there anybody who wishes to comment on this resolution? Okay, seeing that no one's going to comment on it, is there anything further from the board? Okay, so let's have the question. Do we need a roll call vote on this? We do. Okay, so roll call vote.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisengrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Passes 6-0 with Mr. Millar absent.
Okay, so we'll put some signatures on that, and then we'll move along. Okay, we are now at the determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials.
Good evening. Tonight we have the determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. All needed items have been ordered, and we held a public hearing at the last meeting, so tonight we do ask that you approve the resolution.
Mrs. Roger.
I will move approval of resolution number 041415, determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials.
Dr. Eisengrath Rogers.
I will second.
So we have a motion and a second. Is there any further board discussion? Is there anybody who in the public who wish to comment on this? Okay, seeing no one, we will put the motion to a vote.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisengrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 6-0 with Mr. Millar absent.
Thank you. That was quick and efficient. All right. We are now to item 9.01, the appointment of a replacement voting delegate to the SLO CSBA and a nomination to the county committee on school district reorganization. Dr. Prater.
Yes, Mr. President, I'm seeking your action tonight on these two components. One is to select or appoint a county committee member to the SLO CSBA board that will replace Walt Millar, because he will not be able to be at the next voting meeting. And so in addition to that, to nominate Will Jones, who has agreed to be our nominee for that district reorganization committee. So those two parts are what I'm seeking tonight, and I think they're timely and important, as we need to get these in by the end of the month.
Okay, in order for me to get this clear once more, that we need a board member to step forward.
To agree to be on the committee.
On the committee. And then we also have to approve from our district, our supervisorial district, endorsement of Will Jones.
Correct.
Correct. Are there any questions or comments?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer.
Are these two, or do we handle each of these separately?
I think it should be two separate motions.
Okay.
And I just want to make clear to you that the appointment of the board member delegate that we're asking for tonight is only to complete the remainder
right.
of that representative term until our organizational meeting in December.
Okay.
And the seat is up again. So
it could
be a one-shot meeting.
Right, and they have to be at a particular meeting. It's November, do you know that off
16th,
the top of your
head? I believe. November 17th.
No, they have to be available November 17th.
Yes.
So.
And if I may, I would like to suggest that Mr. Unger take that one-time meeting, if you are available. I know you have a very busy schedule now that you're retired.
It's true, and I could do the 17th.
Are you willing to do the 17th?
Yes.
Okay, well, Oh, Mrs. Roger.
Then I'll second Mr. Unger for that position.
Okay, and I don't know if we need public comment on this or not, but I will open it to public comment. And seeing none, we'll move on. There is a motion to nominate Mr. Unger to represent us on this august group. So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And we have one absence, so it's 6-0. And Mr. Unger, do us proud. We have one more item, don't we?
Yes.
Okay, and that is the endorsement.
Second motion on Mr. Jones.
Yes.
I move to nominate Mr. Will Jones as our representative.
And I will second that. Is there any public comment? No. Okay. Any further discussion? Mrs. Roger.
Well, I just would take this opportunity to thank Mr. Jones for his willingness in retirement to represent us on this group. They potentially they have very serious work to do that has ramifications for all of the districts in the county, and I know that he's a very conscientious individual and that he will not take this assignment lightly if selected.
And I will second those observations. Is there any further question or discussion? Okay, seeing none, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed or abstaining? Motion passes 6-0 with one absence. All right, we are now on to the reappointment of the personnel commissioner.
Yes, and that would be me.
Yes.
So we have had Gail Sears serving on our personnel commission for many years now. Gail was a classified employee within the district starting in 1983, and she's worked in a variety of library capacities classified. She's done an excellent job as the classified employee appointee to the personnel commission, and we're recommending that you approve her reappointment.
Mrs. Roger?
I will move reappointment of Mrs. Sears as the classified representative to the Personnel Commission.
And I'll second that. So is there any further discussion from the board? Is there any public comment? Okay, so all in favor of the reappointment of Gail Sears to the Personnel Commission, indicate by saying aye or yes.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And so it passes 6-0 and one absence. Thank you very much. We are now to the single plans for student achievement.
Thank you. Before I start with the single plans of student achievement, since I saw somebody looking, I should find out. It is top of the 7th, Giants 5, Royals 0. Bumgarner has limited the Royals to 2 hits, I believe. Anyway, that's not why I'm in front of you. I've been paying careful attention to the board meeting. Under both California Education Code and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, when schools and districts commingle their federal and state categorical funds under one consolidated application, each site is responsible to put together a single plan for student achievement, the SPSA, which we're going to share with you tonight. Before we have Mrs. Shields and Mrs. McGrath share an overview of these plans, I'd like to address kind of the interesting place we are in developing them. We're sort of in the middle of one of those pendulum swings that happen in public education and have happened many times in my career. In 2001, when the No Child Left Behind Act was authorized, the focus was on two overarching things. One was having highly qualified teachers in front of our kids. And the second was having defined, though different in every state, discrete standards that could be objectively measured for all students, and then raising that bar each and every year until every school in every situation in the nation was proficient. We know that credentialed teachers with college majors in the subjects they teach is very important, but we also know that credentials alone don't determine quality in the classroom. Likewise, the focus on standard-based proficiency has allowed us to focus on all students, made us pay attention to our EL students, our socioeconomically disadvantaged students. It has raised the bar for everybody. But we also know that a mishmash of standards that are different in each state, putting all of our focus on discrete, multiple-choice types of measurements and assessments, has actually left our nation's students behind, globally speaking. And it is foolish to think that we are Lake Wobegon, where all women are strong, all men are good-looking, and all students are above average. In fact, that's a good common core math problem. If all students are above average, what does average mean? So we are moving to a different place where accountability is still vitally important, but where we are using standards that are common across state lines, that are internationally benchmarked and not discrete, true, false, multiple choice, but they're rigorous and based on critical thinking and actually based on creativity. We've adopted a teacher evaluation system that is not about just having the right credentials, but about developing skill sets in a variety of domains over time. So hopefully that pendulum doesn't swing too far, because we don't want to lose that commitment that NCLB brought us, which is to be responsive to the students of this generation and the world that they will inherit. We want accountability. So think of the analogy of getting a driver's license for the first time. We first take an objective multiple-choice test. It is scored, and there is no getting around that score. We understand the rules of the road are not based on that score we get. If you don't pass, you are not proficient to drive. It's black and white. It's important, because we don't want people on the road who don't understand the rules. But then we take a behind-the-wheel test, and it is entirely more complicated. It's very labor-intensive. It requires a one-to-one assessment. It's expensive. We have to have a one-to-one assessor do that test. You have to bring your own car. There is undoubtedly a lot of things that go into making that assessment accurate. It takes calibration of the assessors. But it's also really important, because we don't want people on the road who just understand the rules. We want them proficient in the skill of driving. Which brings me to the single plans for student achievement. Our schools, all 15 of them, are more aligned in their focus than at any time in the history of our district. We developed a local control accountability plan by listening to our stakeholders. The board adopted 6 focus areas. Our schools all, every one of them, use those 6 areas as their site focus, working with their management team, their teachers, their school site council. So it's really a beautiful thing. But we are lacking sufficient assessment data to really hone our focus. As we are in the middle of this pendulum swing, and as we develop, and as the state develops, those assessments that both measure our children's understanding of the rules of the road and the skills necessary to drive, we don't have as much meat as we'd like to have, especially in terms of good data. So take this year's SPSAs as a work in progress, because that's what actually SPSAs are intended to be. They're intended to be a living, changing document that we adjust, like the LCAP itself. As the state assessments get authorized, as we make pragmatic these new Common Core standards that we're working with, we'll get better details in our plans, but we're proud of what we have right now. So I'd like to introduce first Amy Shields, who will give you some background on our elementary plans.
Good evening. Our elementary single plans for student achievement goals are written, as Rick said, around the 6 focus areas that are aligned completely with both our LEA plan and our LCAP. The first 2 focus areas include specific student achievement targets in mathematics, reading, and writing based on our district common assessments, which, although we're in between CST and SBAC coming, those assessments are pretty darn strong, and we're pretty proud of them. Focus Area 3 describes site goals and actions to provide student access to STEAM opportunities. In elementary, we're certainly not as far along as our secondary friends, but we want our kids getting exposure and access to STEAM, and our school sites are beginning that process of figuring out what that might look like. Focus Area 4 is about creating an intentional culture of care, intervention, and support for students, and this includes attendance data as well as specific site goals. Focus Area 5 describes how sites will expand technology and provide innovation for students as well as teachers. And of course, Focus Area 6 sums it up with describing how sites will use the data cycle to improve student achievement. And just a word or two about data cycle. This is the process that our teachers are using particularly well this year in elementary to closely look at student learning. And they do this by looking at the latest assessment, a latest writing sample or work sample, or even a writing from a journal. Once they have this, they take a look at the strengths or successes in the student work, what that child's doing well towards mastery of a specific standard or a specific area in that subject. And from there, they look at what might be the next instructional moves, be it grouping or a specific strategy or a teaching way to promote that next step in learning. And it truly is a cycle. You take a look at the work, you move forward with a plan, you go back and you teach, and then you come back and you look at student work again. And we're trying to make this a natural part of what happens in our elementary world. So those are the six focus areas. In addition to that, goals were set by our sites with targets based not only on the common assessments, but site-specific goals around the focus areas depending on where that each site was at on those goals.
For the secondary single plans for student achievement, site leaders have worked with leadership at their site as well as their school site councils that are comprised of school staff, parents, and students in order to analyze data and then to give input about the school plans. You'll find an alignment, as Rick and Amy have mentioned, to the six focus areas and also to the LEA plan. At the three high schools, remember that they also need to consider their WAS goals, and so their WAS goals have an alignment in those plans as well. Although many of our data points are in the beginning stages, we will continue to work with principals on how to utilize data and create goals in order to help drive student improvement and school improvement as a whole. So tonight we ask that you approve our single plans for student improvement and let us know if you have any questions.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. With regard to the secondary, I do understand that there's that we're in flux and that that's somewhat reflected in the plans. For the elementary, in looking through it, one thing kind of jumped out at me. It's a really minor thing, Mrs. Shields, but I really liked it. It happens to be from Bishop's Peak, and it is under technology, where they, as part of their plan, they propose that all classrooms will develop and maintain a classroom website. They were the only school that I saw that was proposing that, and I love the idea of that because it really gives the students in that class a buy-in. You know, our class, our website, our activities, what's important to us, and I thought that was a terrific idea, and I just wanted to make mention of it. Beginning with last year, I spoke to Mr. Robinette about it. We used to receive copies of all of the individual plans. We no longer receive those, and although there's quite a bit of redundancy there in the form that they take, I would like to request that for next year that we receive those copies again, just so that we can take a look at them. It's a lot of reading, and I don't know how many people actually really go through them, but sometimes you can pick out great kernels of things that are happening at various sites.
With the caveat that we get the executive summary as well.
Oh, yeah. Got to have the executive summary. Okay. So those are my comments. I'm sure other people have comments. Otherwise, I would move to approve.
Mr. Unger.
I just really want to thank you and the schools for the amount of work you did. A question that I had regarded the STEAM portion of the elementary plan, and several of the schools talked about access to and participate in STEAM clubs. Specifically, what do we mean when we talk about access to and how do we measure it? That's really my first question.
How about I go with that? Yeah. Elementary? All right. I think we mean based on from where they're starting from.
Okay.
Some of our sites began some STEAM opportunities last year, be it in after school, before school offerings. Some of our schools did not yet begin that process. So I think we're looking at numbers of kids that are being involved in it. I know one specific example that comes to mind this year is Bishop's Peak is starting a STEAM opportunity that's actually going to be for all third through sixth graders. It's going to be a Friday afternoon during their school day where they'll have different offerings but all connected to STEAM, and they'll offer that two or three different times during the school year. That would be something that he's going to be able to measure very, very cleanly and clearly. For other school sites that are at beginning stages, it might be offered for interested students. It might be an after-school or before-school program.
So the proof would be
numbers
of things that were offered and participants.
That's
and then
right.
Maybe a zero baseline, maybe something else, right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. And then the second thing I just wanted to comment, when you look through the numbers, and I would invite anybody who's listening or watching to look through the numbers, it's so apparent that the achievement gap exists, and it's unfortunately alive and well in our district. And I look at what our schools are doing, and they are working to close that achievement gap. I think special mention should be made of Hawthorne, who, when we look at the baseline data, the 2014 baseline data, their goal for 14-15 is 100% proficiency for all of their students. Now, I think that's going to be difficult for them to achieve, but I think it's a laudable goal, and I wanted to specifically shout out to Mr. Collins and the rest of the Hawthorne staff. And that's not to take anything away from the rest of our schools, but it's an ambitious goal, and I wish them and everybody else well on it.
Thank you, Mr. Unger. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Thank you, Mrs. McGrath. Under goals, let's see what the heading is here, focus area 3, it talks about action steps and tasks. And the very last one is modernize and improve middle school and high school elective programs using CTE pathways. So would that refer to what we have previously called the wheel, and how will that look?
So that refers more to, we just as Common Core has impacted English language arts and math, career tech electives also have new standards called model standards that they've been asked to look at how are they preparing students for college and career readiness. So it's helping to look at pathways that have been established and making sure that our elective programs in middle schools and high schools feed modernized, appropriate pathways so that students are ready for current college and career opportunities. So it helps the career tech elective teachers understand their new model standards and modernize their programs so that they're preparing students for post-secondary work that's appropriate in today's time.
So what might a course offering be that would fit that description?
So one thing I'll throw out that we received the California Partnership Grant, right, that's going to help us develop pathways within our information communication technology. So it would be courses that are helping to build towards students' ability to enter computer science fields, coding, programming, things along those lines. So it could be courses that we currently have, and it's just adjusting what is offered within that course so that it is modernized to what students need. Or it could be looking at, are there additional courses that needed to be added to that pathway?
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just have a question. It's kind of very nitpicky. I'm sorry. I was looking at the goals for by June of 2015, truancy and chronic absenteeism will decrease, and ADA will increase. And it's in the secondary document. It's on, I'm looking for the page number. Hang on. It's on page, right there, I see it. Thank you. It's on page 8 of 12. And it was odd to me the way that's phrased, because it's clear to me that the schools, as they put this information in, it seems unclear whether they're reporting an increase in ADA or a decrease in chronic absenteeism. At least that's what it looks like. So it says truancy, and then I see 28%, 99%, 36%, 48%. It seems to me that they may have been unclear on this, or am I... Because Pacific Beach is 99%
Yeah, there is a strange calculation that goes into packed beaches and attendance and
data. So there's actually a calculation that these numbers are based on?
There is, correct. Okay. And so they look at their current 13-14 data, and then they determine the goal based on that. But I will say for packed beach, it is a very complicated formula because of the way their attendance is calculated by credits and not by full
actual
days.
Seats and chairs.
Right, so okay. it is a strange calculation on that one, I agree. But it is. They did, look at what goal and what was in place last year and determine a goal for this year.
So it looks like the first two rows there, truancy and chronic absenteeism, are the ones you're supposed to be decreasing, and the last row is the one where there's your average daily attendance is supposed to be increasing.
Exactly.
Okay, that wasn't clear to me at first.
You want kids there more so that they're...
Yes, okay. Well, then those goals are laudable. All right.
And I would say that the thing we focus most of our energy on is that middle one, chronic absenteeism.
Right.
Truancy is a very difficult term.
Yes.
We think of truancy as students ditching school.
Right.
And truancy is actually anyone who's 30 minutes late to school is a truant for the fact that their parents couldn't drive them there on time, for example. That is a measurement of truancy. So it's important, and we need to calculate all of them, but chronic absenteeism is what we really like to pay attention to.
And truancy is also determined if there's a if it's not for an illness or one of the few other
unexcused absences. Yeah. And three instances of it make somebody a chronic truant,
right.
Which is kind of difficult to
yes.
to pin on somebody.
Right.
But chronic absenteeism, that's important. That's students missing a lot of school.
Okay.
And that's an important measurement for us.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up for us. All right. Thank you very much for the presentation. Mrs. Roger.
I'd like to move approval of the single plans for student achievement.
Oh, that's correct.
2014-15.
Okay, so the motion to approve by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Any further discussion? Any public comment? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0 with one absence. All right, we'll move on. Are we on the action consent agenda, folks? I believe we are. So if you wish an item pulled, please let me know. So we have item 10.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items.
Pull.
Okay, we'll pull that item. Is that you, Mr. Unger? Okay. Disposition of surplus property. 10.03, acceptance of donations. Okay. And that was you, Mrs. Sheffer, correct? Okay. So that's 10.03, correct? And 10.04, approval of furniture and equipment requests. And finally, 10.05, approval of purchase orders. Okay, so I need a motion on items 10.01.
Isn't that the one you pulled?
No, that's pulled. 10.02.
4 and 5.
That's correct.
I'll move approval of items 10.02, 10.04, and 10.05.
I'll second that. Is there any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Motion carries 6-0. All right. Mr. Unger.
Yeah, thank you. I pulled item 10.01 because there are two people that I'd like to recognize who are retiring from our organization effective, I understand, next month. And the first person I want to they're both senior custodians. And, of course, people should realize, at least when I went to school to learn how to be a speech pathologist, and they talked about who are the two people that you really need to know in the school to make your life better. First was the school secretary, and second was the school custodian. And we have two school custodians who have been with us quite a while who are retiring, and they both need to be recognized. The first is Donna Kirtley. Donna's been our custodian at the adult school. I think as long as we've been going up there. Donna suffered a recent tragedy in her life. I don't know if that affected her reasoning for retirement, but we are just going to miss the heck out of Donna, and I just wanted to thank her for her long service to the school district. And really, the kindness and the special attention she's paid to the board when we've had meetings there. And the second person I want to recognize is Dan McShane, who's longtime custodian, senior custodian at Del Mar Elementary School. To say that Dan is beloved would be an understatement. They are going to miss the heck out of Dan at that school. He has just been a gem, and I can't say enough for the great things that he's done. So I just really wanted to wish Donna and Dan the best retirement they can have, and just know that we're going to miss the heck out of them. And with that, I'd like to move approval of item 10.01.
And I'll second that motion. Any further discussion? Further comment? All in favor of item 10.01, the approval of certificated and classified personnel items, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0 with one absence. All right, Mr. Sheffer, acceptance of donations, item 10.03.
You know, I always enjoy paying attention to the donations, what they're for, who they're from. And I wanted to point out a couple of things on our donation list this time. Elaine Rosenfeld, previous Teacher of the Year in our district, now retired, is still very active in the district, and she has donated 3 iPads to Bishop's Peak. So it says a lot for our retired personnel who continue to give back to our district, and I want to let her know we appreciate that. Sally Ames is responsible for generating nearly $9,500 in donations to the adult school, which is playing a larger and larger role in our community services that we provide to our community at large in San Luis Coastal. And kudos to her for putting that together and realizing such a great amount of money. And then last but not least, as I look through these, the former PTA president in me just has to speak to, we're still pretty early in the year. Anyone watching, please join your local PTA, your school PTA. It really does great things, provides wonderful things for the school sites. And also seeing how Teach received about $250 from the Target Take Charge of Education program. All those opportunities for SCRIP or box tops for education, all those things that seem so small and maybe like you're not really contributing too much, it really adds up. The more people who participate and contribute, take these opportunities to contribute, it has a huge impact on our sites. And I would encourage everyone to find out what's available out there and how you can contribute. So having said that, I will move acceptance of item 10.03, move approval, acceptance of donations.
And I'll second that. So we have a motion for approval and a second. Mr. Sheffer moved and I second it. So all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0 with one absence. All right, we are now on the action. We're on the advanced agenda. Is there any interesting? Mr. Unger.
Yes. I would like the board to consider directing the administration to investigate whether, in fact, we could use the potential bond passage as a way to institute what could almost be considered a career academy for construction management and for the construction arts, I mean, I almost would say. We have an opportunity to look at having our students work with architects, with construction management, with engineering, carpenters, plumbers, electricians. I don't know what the cost would be. I don't know if it's feasible. I don't know if anybody has ever done this in the past, but it seems to me we talk about STEAM, we talk about career readiness. If there's any way that we could use this phenomenal opportunity that we have, this $177 million, to engage our students in career readiness in those fields, I would encourage us to do it. We have the opportunity to work with Cal Poly. I think we have the opportunity to work with Cuesta. I know that in Northern California, the Northern California Carpenters work hard to do apprenticeships with students. So I think it would. I would like to know if that's even feasible for us to investigate as part of having our students get their A to G requirements through something like that. So I'd like some. I'd like support to have the administration investigate whether that's something that would be feasible or not.
I'll support that. As
Dr. Eisenrath Rogers, okay.
Yeah, sorry, just supporting that idea.
Okay. Dr. Prater, you're reaching for your microphone there.
Yeah, Chris and I had lunch the other day. I think it's what a wonderful opportunity to be progressive, use the, if assuming the bond passes, use that whole 5 to 7 year process to make it an enriching cross-learning experience. And I, the one thing I would need to really investigate is the A through G.
Can we do it?
I don't know about that, but perhaps it could be connected to it through a design that we invent. You know, so I'd be willing to look at it. I think it'd be super creative.
Mr. Buckman. Okay, I just was anticipating you. You were reaching for your button.
Did you anticipate me?
That's really cool.
Mr. Robinette, you were sort of nodding your head in a thoughtful way there.
There's lots of issues with all of that, you know, in terms of working with, you know, contractors and labor issues and things like that. But in terms of an educational opportunity for students, I think it's absolutely something we should look into for internships, you know, curricular connections. Yeah, I think it's worthy of our investigation.
Thank you, Mr. Robinette. Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. My knee-jerk on it is there are certainly liability issues with students in the field and what have you, and we would need to be very cautious about that. But I think exposing our students to architectural drawings, engineering drawings, construction, CPM scheduling, there are aspects to it that could be very beneficial to students, if only to dipstick their interest in pursuing those career paths. So I'm supportive of spending some time looking into how we might integrate the benefit of the school improvements with the educational opportunities for our students.
I guess I got it to work.
Okay, Mr. Buckman, it's your turn to weigh in.
Thank you, sir. I think this is it's a phenomenally good idea. I think it was 3 years ago, the state, there's a change in the Ed Code that allows districts to replace one of the A to G electives with ROP CTE classes. So the pathway to go to A to G is there and open if we can take advantage of it. My only caution or my only thought is you know, we've got staff just running in that, you know, little chipmunk wheel, and I'm just so scared that, you know, to add some more on just maybe something. We might want to do this, I don't know, you know, shadow our own classified staff or something. But I'm so scared of adding so much, but it's a great opportunity. There's no, obviously no.
Yeah, and
Mr. Unger.
And I think that's exactly right, Mark and Marilyn, is let's look at it. Let's see if we can do it. Is it feasible, and what can we do? And then take it from there. Once you guys take a look at it, and if you can bring us back some information, it'd be great.
Okay. All right. We are now on the board reports, so I'm looking for lights to go on. Anybody have a report for the board? I will make a very brief one. I was at Morro Bay High School yesterday, and I did get a chance to talk with folks in the athletic department, a Spanish teacher, and a science teacher. So I can report to you that the football team is there working very hard, trying to keep everybody eligible for the remainder of the season. And I actually saw students excused from practice to get their assignments done and turned in. So, and I was assured by the football coach that on a weekly basis, he has a study session for those athletes to make sure they get their work done. And with that, I'm done. Mr. Buckman, you have a light on for a report.
Yeah, just really quickly, just want everybody to know there's no special treatment for school board members at carnivals. I did get to attend both C.L. Smith and Bishop's Peaks Carnival. I spent a lot of money on raffle tickets. I put all my raffle tickets for one thing, and I didn't get it. And I couldn't blow the candles out, so just no special treatment for board members.
Well, I have an almost sure winner for you, Mr. Buckman. Just stay. See me after the meeting.
It's got something to do with the Rotary in Morro Bay.
It might be. It might have something to do with that. Mr. Unger.
Just a reminder, I went and got my flu shot today at Laguna. Got a chance to talk to Mr. Calandro. The flu shots are continuing tomorrow at Morro Bay High School from 12 to 5. And on Thursday at the district office from 12 to 5, employees, CISC is providing flu shots for free at Costco if you miss those times. So everybody, please go out and get your flu shots.
And family members, too.